The Nobel Prize in Economics has been awarded for the 50th time, and this year it went to two Americans. This year's winners congratulated specifically for their work in integrating climate change and technological innovation into economic analysis. Nordhaus & Roemer's $1 million award was the last of the 2018 awards to be announced.
Amid growing criticism over pay disparity, Amazon announced Tuesday it will hike the minimum wage to $15 an hour for all of its U.S. workers. In a statement, founder and CEO Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, said, quote, "We listened to our critics, thought hard about what we wanted to do, and decided we wanted to lead."
Walmart is teaming up with MGM. The studio Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer will create content for the retailer's video-on-demand service, Vudu. Walmart will license family-friendly content that MGM will produce. The shows will be exclusively licensed for a period of time to Vudu in North America and available on its free ad-supported service, Movies on Us.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's October the 9th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Here we are with another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. Thank you for joining us. It's good to have you along this morning. We've put together a really good broadcast for you today. Have you ever been in a restaurant and had to return something or service is not up to what you expect it to be? Doug Roth is here today, our restaurant expert, to talk to us a little bit about what the process should be, how you should react, how the restaurant should react. Good information that we'll talk to Doug about this morning. He'll be in our first segment this morning. And then a little bit later in the program, Matthew Bragg will be here. He's the Director of Data and Policy at the Illinois Science and Technology Coalition. Some new numbers on research and development innovation in Illinois. We'll go through some of those numbers coming up at about 5:40 this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Asian markets are mixed after the IMF downgraded its economic outlook, citing rising interest rates and mounting tensions over trade. This morning in Asia, the Nikkei is going to end down about 314 points, more than a percent and a third. The Hang Seng is going to be lower as well by about a quarter. The Shanghai up just a fraction. In Europe, markets are generally in the red this morning, with the FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC all off about a quarter percent to almost a half a percent in Germany. In the United States, futures are pointing toward another negative open at the opening bell later this morning. Dow futures are off more than a half a percent, down 136 points. NASDAQ futures and S&P futures down about a half a percent each as well. And oil is trading at $74.73 a barrel. The International Monetary Fund is downgrading its outlook for the world economy, citing rising interest rates and growing tensions over trade. The IMF says the global economy will grow 3.7% this year, the same as in 2017, but down from the 3.9% it was forecasting for 2018 back in July. It slashed its outlook for the 19 countries that use the euro currency and for Latin America, the Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF expects the U.S. economy to grow 2.9% this year, the fastest since 2005 and unchanged from the July forecast. But it predicts that U.S. growth will slow to 2.5% next year as the effect of recent tax cuts wears off and as President Trump's trade war with China takes a toll. The Trump administration is moving to allow year-round sales of gasoline with higher blends of ethanol. That's going to be a boom for farmers like those in Iowa and other farm states like Illinois that have pushed for greater sales of corn-based fuel. The president expected to announce he's lifting a federal ban on summer sales of ethanol blends during a trip to Iowa today. And a push to give the Justice Department more enforcement authority over the lucrative and at times shadowy world of foreign lobbying has stalled amid opposition from pro-business groups, nonprofits, and privacy advocates, organizations that range from the influential U.S. Chamber of Commerce to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers have raised objections to legislation that would sharpen the teeth of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. How do you complain at a restaurant without being a jerk? And what should you expect when you do complain? Restaurant expert Doug Roth is with us this morning. Doug is the president and CEO of Playground Hospitality in Chicago. Comes from a long line of restaurateurs. Doug, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Steve, I am always happy to be here.
We're going to have a great conversation today because this is some of the stuff that I am kind of hesitant to ever do. And I'm kind of shy about it. What do you do in a restaurant when things don't go the way they should? How should you complain? When should you complain? What should you expect? Those sorts of things. So let's just begin generally with whether you're in a fine dining restaurant or anywhere, what are the different scenarios where you might want to complain?
Well, let's start walking in the door of a restaurant. And this is a restaurant that's taken a reservation. So what is your expectation, Steve, as far as how much time you should wait between the time that you have the reservation, let's say it's 8 o'clock, and the time you're sat?
I don't know, maybe a half an hour at most.
Well, you're being very nice. We normally look at about 20 minutes.
Okay.
And we feel after 20 minutes that at that point that we're sort of going into the red zone. And at that juncture is when it becomes very interesting is how different restaurants and different restaurant management handle a reservation that goes into and past that 20 minutes.
What? And so if it's past that 20 minutes, what should you expect, first off, as the customer?
Well, first of all, to be recognized by the fact, I'm sorry that we're running over our time. Because in all candor, reservations, and there are reservation systems out there today that really help to give the restaurateur more information about how often the table is going to turn, how long people are staying at the table, are they on dessert, are they on check. All of those things are information now from a technological standpoint that is giving us good, what I'll say is information, so to speak, mm-hmm. in order to understand how to seat a restaurant. But that isn't a perfect science and never will be a perfect science.
Yeah.
So as a result, what we try to do is then how can we give options to the guest? And I think we're going to be talking a lot about options today so that people feel that you're important. And we're going to make sure that that experience is going to be top-notch. So one of the things that we'll do, for instance, is come over, say to you, excuse me, sir, I'm sorry that you're waiting longer than we would like. One thing that I never do is buy a drink. I always feel that buying drinks also adds to the fact that you've already been drinking, and it's probably time to get a little food in your stomach. Mm. So what we'll do is we'll either provide something for you at the bar where you're waiting, such as an appetizer, or have appetizers waiting at your table. Very inexpensive way of appeasing and going beyond what the expectation is for most guests.
The next step would be to get to your table, and let's say it's not exactly to your liking. What could happen at the seating?
Well, unfortunately, my family, growing up in the restaurant business, we had sort of a rule, which I can't tell you is a rule that everyone should have, was that don't show me your first table, but show me your second table. Somehow or another, I just grew up in that environment, maybe because I'm the son of a restaurateur, that the first table was never going to be as good as the second table. Sort of like the same thing in a hotel. So, but normally it's going to be. But if it's near the kitchen or it's near a washroom or it's just noisy, you know, just ask and say, excuse me, is that table over there available this afternoon or this evening? The one thing, too, that also sort of individuals should know as well, and your listening audience is, listen, there's nothing wrong when it's not busy to ask for a larger table. I mean, the fact is most likely they're not going to have four people sitting at a table at 5 or 5:30 or 6 or something like that. So say, excuse me, can I have a four top instead of a two top? I mean, I'm using obviously a restaurant vernacular, but certainly there's nothing wrong with asking for a bigger table.
If it's the height of dinner time, though, and everything is full, that may not be something that can be granted, right?
No, it can't be granted, but listen, you can always say, listen, I'll wait for a bigger table.
Okay.
Or I'll wait, you know, how much longer is it for another table that's not necessarily by the washroom? So that's not a problem. And there's no reason why someone shouldn't grant you that. You may have to wait a few minutes longer, but now it's on your clock, not the restaurant's.
So we're sitting and getting our orders put in. Everything seems to be going well. The food comes out, and let's say something is not exactly to our liking. How do we know that what's the threshold of saying something to somebody? And, you know, how serious is it? Because I always think, okay, if my steak isn't completely done the way I asked for it, well, maybe I'll let it slide. But is there anything too small that would be a problem to say, hey, something's wrong?
Well, the way that I have been trained is that nothing is too small. And I guess what's important is that the guest has to realize that you're doing the restaurant a favor by telling them that your particular steak is undercooked. Or the fact is that it has most particularly an item on it, let's say peanuts. And God forbid that someone forgot to ask if there was anyone at the table that had an allergy issue. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's obviously, you're headed down the wrong road with that. My feeling is really there's nothing too unusual that can't be necessarily remedied by taking either the entree back or giving some other option to the table if for something isn't right. The problem you run into is that that people most of the time feel uncomfortable complaining. Oh, the chef's going to do something to my food in the back, or somehow or another that there's a feeling that they're going to be punished or looked upon poorly by the restaurant.
I always think this, by the way.
That's ridiculous. Yeah, this is like any other business. If a shirt has a stain on it and you bought it at Nordstrom's, you're going to take it back. What are they going to do? I mean, it isn't right. So when something isn't right, you get it fixed. And that's no different in the restaurant business or hotel business or the service business. So it's important. Now, what it does do, it does throw off everyone else's dinner. So a smart restaurant tour or a smart restaurant manager is going to say, "Gee, Steve, while you're waiting, let me bring you a cup of soup. Let me bring you a salad while everyone else is dining." So at least you're having a little something to eat. And what did that soup cost the guy? 50 cents? What did the salad cost? Maybe 50 cents. But at least it allows the experience to be the same. And again, it exceeded your expectation.
I've been in that situation where I've set something back and I've been the only one at the table not eating. And I've always thought, well, it's kind of rude of everybody else to be eating. But if they already have their food, that's right. That's a great solution to that problem.
Yes. Yeah. And it's an easy solution to cover. It really is.
People always say, you know, how quickly should you say something when you realize something's not to your liking? I'm guessing the sooner the better, not sit there and stew in it for a while.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Actually, the thing that's important is immediately, because there are a couple of things that can happen. One is maybe what we'll do is we'll beg, borrow, and steal from the kitchen. So let's say you ordered a strip sirloin and it is overdone. Well, it just might happen that a table near you has a steak that's on the grill, and you basically take that person's steak and provide it to your table. So you're going to have it probably in a couple minutes. Because we'll beg from, we'll steal basically from other orders. So that's really not a major problem. When it becomes a problem, and the thing that I don't understand is when someone finishes their meal and then basically says, "Geez, I really didn't like how it was prepared," then you sort of wonder, okay, what's going on here? You have to listen, and that's most important. I think the guest has to feel heard, but then there's a little bit of how come you didn't tell me a little sooner about that? That would have been helpful.
And then there's the, you know, how you should behave when all of this is happening. I've been in restaurants where I've seen scenes develop at tables where the person who's bringing an issue up is not very nice. I'm guessing there's a level of politeness that has to go with all of this, doesn't there? Isn't there?
Well, the old adage, you get a lot more with honey than vinegar, applies in any business. And I think, listen, hopefully people are mature individuals, and this isn't going to be the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their life or in that week. And we're going to remedy the problem. It's not like that there's a situation where, you know, that you're the enemy, and we're going to try to see how we're going to make it difficult for you. It's those individuals, I think, that understand hospitality and understand giving you options. I can prepare a steak again, or you know something? I have actually prime rib available that I can get right now for you if you'd like that, or I happen to have a pasta item if you'd like it right now, or we can recook the steak for you if they don't have another one that's available. So it's giving people options and letting them choose those options, to me, that makes a difference. But it's most importantly feeling that the guest has been heard and that we are reacting to whatever that particular issue is.
It's also kind of important, too, to not take this out on your server. If we're talking about food that's undercooked or overcooked, the chances of that being the server's fault are pretty slim, aren't they?
Usually very slim, especially when it comes to overcooked food. You don't shoot the messenger. But in this particular case, there can be examples of where the server has forgotten to put in an order and an item. And that happens a lot. Where sometimes, especially with larger tables, that they miscount the amount of people that are at the table. Now, what I appreciate is when the server takes ownership and says, I am so sorry. I forgot to put in an item. And this is where management should step in. And I do believe in empowering your server, and I do believe that a server should be able to buy desserts or get something that's out of the ordinary. In a case where there's a mistake that's been made, and we make mistakes, that what happens is that we then end up having a manager step in and be able to hopefully remedy the problem and give the person the sense that there's something that they can do for you.
You mentioned that you just talked about how the server or the management, if whoever it is that is at your table taking care of this, they would suggest solutions to this. But you as the customer can come up with solutions as well, can't you?
Wide open to solutions as well. I'd prefer not to come up with a solution because I'm here for the purpose of really enjoying myself. If I need to give the business the solution in this particular case, I think they're missing something as being good entrepreneurs and good business people. I think it's up to them to provide the solution, but if I don't have the option that the person's looking for and I'm not hearing what they have to say, yes, of course. If it's, the answer is yes, what's the question? I mean, generally. It can't be that so outlandish. Yes, we have a business that at this point is based on profitability on nickels and dimes. But in all actuality, when you do an act of kindness or even a small act of kindness, that's going to go so much further than when you step back and say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And that is the kind of thing that drives me berserk at times, is when it's so easy to do something and they or other restaurant groups have made it difficult for you to move forward because they are looking at the bottom line versus looking at what the opportunity cost is.
We often hear customers in restaurants or other places, I want to speak to the manager, when they don't feel like they're getting what they have gotten from the server. When do you ask for a manager or the chef?
Well, I think that you should ask when you basically don't feel that you're being heard, or that you feel that in some cases that your server is not someone who you're feeling is very competent. And there's nothing wrong also if you're not getting along with your server to ask for another server. You can trade tables. I mean, sometimes you're just not gelling. And I've had that happen as well. And it's not anyone's fault, per se. And if you're not enjoying the initial experience, bail and get another server. And there's nothing wrong with asking the manager, listen, we're not on the same page. And I think it's time that maybe you find another server for the table.
When everything is said and done and it comes time to pay the bill, should we expect some of this to be free? And then also, what should our reaction be with tipping? Should we, if everything has been fixed properly, should this incident have affected our tip at all?
Well, I think there's a couple ways of looking at it. I'm a real strong believer in comping, and because if you didn't get your steak and it came late, take it off the bill. If in fact you got something else instead of the steak, take it off the bill. If everyone's been inconvenienced as a result of your experience, dessert is a very inexpensive food cost item that can go a long way. So there's so many different things that you can do, but I do believe in most cases it probably wasn't the server's problem, is you tip on the whole check amount. You don't just tip on what has been taken off the bill as a result of an issue that you may have had in the kitchen or you have had with even the server. We all make mistakes. Is it really worth being punitive as a result of it? These individuals, don't make a heck of a lot of money. And as a result, I'm sure that they would enjoy the fact that you noticed the fact that they went beyond the call of duty.
Speaking of punitive, I know there are folks that, if they had a bad experience at a restaurant, and let's say they didn't speak up at the restaurant, or they just kind of endured it, and then they go immediately and write a bad Yelp review. When should we be, you know, writing these Yelp reviews, and what should go into them? And if, I guess we should be fair as customers when writing these things, shouldn't we?
I have seen, obviously, such a large change in where that's, I guess, happened today, as far as that everyone has become a restaurant critic. And I guess you're dealing with individuals who have had a lot of experience in restaurants, and then a lot of people who have not. I believe that you have to give opportunities to individuals to solve your problem and give them time to solve your problem. Sometimes it might not be exactly that day. Maybe a manager calls you back and says, I understood you had a problem at our restaurant, Mr. Roth. Can you tell me what happened? And, you know, gosh, I'm going to send you XYZ to come back in again, because you want that repeat. So in my view, you have to give the restaurant the opportunity to solve the issue within the four walls, which I call the four walls theory. People don't remember the problem. They remember how it's solved. And I guess, to answer your question then, if it isn't solved satisfactorily and you've tried different routes, okay, then maybe the only thing you can do is go to Yelp. But I think what happens is that people pull the trigger too often, and as a result, they are harsh. And you can make or break a business, but remember, the world is round. Things come back around. So in those individuals' businesses, they might find themselves under the same sort of fire that they started for someone else.
Here's another one for you, Doug. What happens if, let's say, we go out to a restaurant? It doesn't even have to be a fine dining restaurant, but we get sick. And let's say we get home and we're sick. At what point do we contact the restaurant, or do we contact the restaurant? What's the protocol with that?
Well, you said we, and we is concerning. First of all, we used to have people or individuals that would call as soon as they got home from an experience. And it's not often by any means, but that person said, I got sick as soon as I got home. Well, in that particular case, red flags go up. Unless that individual has ingested a tremendous amount of bacteria, then most likely it is something, either one, that they've had a meal earlier in the day. It takes 8 hours for most illnesses to manifest themselves from food poisoning. So if they haven't necessarily had something within that 8 hours, and then go to the restaurant, well, maybe there's a shot. But the other thing that you need to look at is, you go back to your we. If you and a friend have been at the restaurant and you both get ill, yes, you should immediately call the restaurant. And most restaurants should have in place a plan for when guests become ill. And how they handle that plan is extremely important as to how you feel comfortable. I would say, with how they've worked with you on that and the process that they have in place in order for you to get comfortable. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that.
And if it's just me, if just I get sick and not anybody else at my table, that probably tells you something as a restaurant as well, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, yeah. And no one else has gotten sick at the restaurant, and just you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I would say that you might have had the stomach flu coming on, and it just happened to manifest itself when you got home or later in the day. But again, if you ate at the restaurant at 6 o'clock and at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're starting to not feel great, and you call the restaurant, and they should be up front. I mean, I've had issues where, yes, multiple individuals have gotten ill. We'll take care of that issue. We've made a mistake. But many times when people feel ill from eating at a restaurant, it's usually because it's either from somewhere else or the fact that just getting sick,
uh-huh.
And it's not necessarily the restaurant.
And there's demographics, too. I saw a recent article that said 52% of millennials, back to the shy part of this, 52% of millennials are uncomfortable sending food back. Do you find that it's depending on demographics, whether somebody complains or not?
I would think that is from the standpoint, if it's not from just in a restaurant or calling up to say that there's been an incident in the restaurant, mm-hmm. such as being ill, yes. I think millennials, and I can think of my own kids, just don't deal with it. And I don't know if that's a thing that is based on how they have brought up in their value system, or they just are... You have to move along a little bit in maturity and ultimately you're going to get to a point and say, there's nothing wrong with it. There really isn't, because what you've done is you haven't given someone the opportunity to fix a problem. And if you don't like the way they fix it, I get it. And Yelp and other means are certainly, social media is certainly a place where you can certainly scream. But you know the other side of the coin of social media as well. Is let people know when they've done a good job at it. Mm. I mean, there are great companies out there and great restaurant groups that do a great job in hospitality. And again, turn that situation into an opportunity and versus necessarily what has been a problem.
Doug, always good information. Thanks for coming in this morning.
I always really enjoy hanging with you, Steve, so hopefully we'll do that soon.
We'll do it again next time.
All right, thanks much.
Doug Roth is the president and founder and CEO of Playground Hospitality. You can find them at playgroundhospitality.com. Doug's fame comes from lots of cool restaurants, Bistro 110, Bistro 100, Black Hawk Lodge, and you may know him from his experience with Levy Restaurants. He's also created multiple nationally recognized restaurant concepts. We're going to continue our conversation with Doug after the bell this morning, and we'll post more of our conversation in the podcast of The Opening Bell at WGNRadio.com a little bit later on this morning.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
We're back on The Opening Bell. Good morning again, everyone. Welcome to our Tuesday edition of the program. Matt Bragg is Director of Data and Policy at Illinois Science and Technology Coalition. Some new data out about research and development innovation in Illinois. Matt is back with us this morning on The Opening Bell. Matt, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Interesting to get into some of the findings of this, but before we get into some of the numbers, tell us again why research and development matters so much in the business world.
Sure. So, you know, I think we really look at research and development as sort of being the lifeblood of innovation. I think businesses, you know, universities and, you know, federal agencies all sort of use R&D to really develop sort of the discoveries that, you know, move economic development forward and, you know, create jobs and sort of improve quality of life for everyone.
So some new numbers, the new Innovation Index, Research and Development Innovation Index is out. There's some key findings from this, but the headline would be what?
You know, I think it's kind of a mixed bag for the state of Illinois. We certainly, you know, we have some areas of strength and, you know, on the business side in terms of, you know, machine manufacturing and, you know, pharmaceuticals still playing a big role in the state, as well as finance and insurance kind of being strengths. You know, on the university side, we certainly have strength in computer science that's kind of been echoed in the talent production data that we've put out recently as well. But, you know, we've also, you know, we've grown sort of more slowly than a lot of peer states since the Great Recession. So sort of a mixed bag, I think, is kind of the headline.
Illinois ranking eighth nationally in total R&D activity. That's not so bad. But still, you mentioned there's a little bit of slowing there. Yeah, any idea why that slowing is happening or has happened?
You know, I think obviously, you know, something as complex as R&D, you know, across sort of the whole economy, there's no one reason, right? It's a complex issue. But, you know, I think obviously on the university side, we have to be realistic and look at the budget impasse as being an issue, especially for, you know, some of the smaller public universities. And then, you know, on the business side, some of the key, you know, sectors that we have at R&D is just sort of, they haven't grown as quickly as sort of the national average.
I know the latest year available for data is 2015. Is it possible that over the last few years with economic growth as good as it has been, that things have been turning around and we just haven't seen that data yet?
Certainly possible. Like you mentioned, the latest year we have is 2015, and that's sort of the way that You know, we get this data from NSF and sort of their collection for the data. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, certainly with the uptick in the economy, sort of how that plays out in the state's R&D numbers.
You mentioned the academic part of this. Talk to us about how important that academic research and development is. I know some smaller schools have been really hit hard by those budget issues and probably have curtailed, maybe even cut completely some of the research and development they've been doing. Why is it important to have those schools doing that research and development?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly important for, you know, some of the smaller schools, you know, as you look around the state regionally. I mean, those are sort of powerhouses, you know, for economic development in their region, some of the smaller universities. So, you know, and over the last few years, I think we've really seen that universities are becoming more important and sort of commercializing that research and, you know, creating startups and using sort of tech transfer to really bring those, you know, inventions and discoveries sort of into the marketplace. So they're really, you know, economic drivers, especially for regions around the state.
I was looking at some of the states that we compete with, and when I mentioned that ranking 8, we're behind California, which is number 1, Massachusetts, Texas, New York, Maryland, Washington, Michigan. California, I get. Massachusetts, I get because I guess what, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Give us a sense of why those other states are ahead of Illinois.
Well, I mean, I think the reason for that would differ on states, but, you know, a lot of those are strong sort of, you know, industry hubs. And certainly when you look at, you know, places like Washington with, you know, Microsoft and Amazon now and sort of their strength in tech and, you know, obviously New York is a huge state as well as Texas. So, I think the reasons sort of differ state to state, but, you know, I think some of those states, you know, if we're being honest, have just grown sort of more quickly in their research and development than we have in recent years.
Right. It's important to remind people that Illinois has 38 Fortune 500 companies, $800 billion mm-hmm. in annual GDP. With that level of company representation on the Fortune 500, you could see why the expectation would be that these numbers would be higher.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think when you look at just, you know, the quantity of Fortune 500 companies we have, I think we're fourth nationally. So you're right. It's sort of a little disappointing from our point of view. So something that, you know, I think we're certainly looking to, you know, looking into the future to sort of build upon in the next, you know, decade or so.
You mentioned the pharmaceutical industry. Can you give us any examples of the research and development that's ongoing by some of these industries recently in the state?
Yeah, so I think what's been encouraging from our point of view is, you know, a lot of the pharma companies in the area, especially sort of the north suburbs, have started, you know, partnering with universities in the state. I mean, that's really something we point to in the report is a way to kind of grow R&D, you know, in the state is to create these sort of university and industry partnerships. So I know Abbott is partnered, I think, with the University of Illinois. AbbVie as well, I think, is partnering with Northwestern. So, you know, those partnerships that kind of, you know, capitalize on the strengths of, you know, industry as well as university can really be effective to drive innovation. And obviously, you know, when you talk about pharma, the life cycle of creating a new discovery is long. So I think we'll see the fruits of that bear out in the coming years.
The report, I encourage everyone who's interested in this to download it and look at it. It's worth the read. ADM, companies like ADM and DuPont and USG, they're all of these companies are working on innovation doing cool things in Illinois.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we have, you know, one of the bright spots are some of the companies that we have here doing really interesting things. I mean, you mentioned the ADM DuPont partnership that's down in Decatur, and they're, you know, really sort of revolutionizing some materials, some plastics for packaging, and they've built sort of a new R&D facility that's really kind of revolutionary. So, as you mentioned, I think there's quite a few bright spots that if you read the report that are, you know, really kind of uplifting for the state.
Matt, good of you to be with us this morning. Always good information. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Steve.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Matt Bragg, Director of Data and Policy at Illinois Science and Technology Coalition will link out to this report so that you can see it firsthand if you want, and have more data there for you to peruse over. But again, it's the Illinois Science and Technology Coalition.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures down this morning heading to The Opening Bell. Dow futures off nearly a half a percent, down 122 points. Same story on the NASDAQ and S&P, each down about a half a percent heading to The Opening Bell. Gold and silver are mixed. Gold is higher and silver is lower. Let's get an update on agriculture and commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Thank you very much, Steve. A pretty good day for livestock traders and producers yesterday as lean hog and live cattle futures climbed to their highest prices in about 7 months, pushing cattle prices higher. Optimism that cash prices will improve this week. Fed cattle in Texas and Kansas stayed mostly steady last week at about $111 per hundredweight. And the rain and muddy conditions probably slowing down weight gains. The December live cattle contract gained just 10 cents for the day, but it closed at $118.25. October feeder cattle down 10 cents, closing at $157.67. And the October lean hogs ended the day up 25 cents per hundredweight at $68.45. U.S. Meat Export Federation said yesterday the value of American beef exports in August topped $750 million for the first time. And beef exports in August totaled 119,850 metric tons. Turning to the grain market, wheat moved lower, technical selling, and a stronger dollar. And at the end of the day, wheat futures were down 7 cents. November soybeans up just 0.75 cents, and December corn up down 1 3/4 cents a bushel. And of course, we did not get the weekly crop progress reports because of the Columbus Day holiday. We'll get them this afternoon. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke has approved a 20-year ban on new mining claims in the mountains north of Yellowstone National Park after two proposed gold mines raised concerns that an area drawing tourists from around the globe could be spoiled. He signed the mineral ban at a ceremony yesterday, and he was joined there by local business owners and residents who pushed very hard for a ban on new mining in Yellowstone or near Yellowstone. Advocates of taxing fossil fuels believe their position is stronger now because of an alarming new report on climate change and the Nobel Prize in Economics awarded to two American economists, but neither development likely to break down political resistance to a carbon tax. Previous alarms about global warming met with resistance from Congress and the White House. President Trump withdrew the United States from the Paris Agreement on climate change last year. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in its report that was released yesterday, suggested that the world has just about 10 years to get temperature under control and to get all of this done. But a few hours later, the Nobel Prize in Economics went to two Americans who've been working on this. Carbon tax is a charge imposed on the burning of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. A federal lawsuit contends the operators of a North Carolina drug rehab program farmed out recovering addicts to work at adult care homes and restaurants and pocketed the wages for the labor they performed. The lawsuit was filed yesterday by defendants in this case. They contend that the enrollment in that residential substance abuse recovery program run by Recovery Connections Community. The plaintiffs say that they and others in recovery worked up to 16 hours a day doing stuff that they probably should not have been doing, including bathing patients and changing diapers. This company, Recovery Connections Community, has outlets across the United States. And Netflix has chosen New Mexico as the site of a new U.S. production hub and is in final negotiations to buy an existing multi-million dollar studio complex on the edge of the state's largest city. Government and corporate leaders announced yesterday.
It is the company's first purchase of such property, and upcoming production work in Albuquerque and at other spots around New Mexico is forecast to result in about $1 billion in spending by Netflix over the next decade. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Tuesday, October the 9th, we'll get the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index today, a look at the Red Book as well. Chicago Fed President Charles Evans has a speech today. John Williams also speaking. Not much in the way of other economic reports today. Tomorrow we'll see the MBA mortgage applications report, wholesale trade. A little bit later in the week, we'll get EIA natural gas and petroleum status reports, and then on Friday, consumer sentiment. So lots of things that could move the markets this week and today on this October the 9th.